Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
It's really nice to be back with all of you. You must be exhausted. I mean, was it last weekend?
Mm-hmm.
I was really sorry not to be here with you, and it's what I'm going to talk about a little today. I've been in England for the last 3 weeks, and it was something that was set up over a year ago, so I couldn't change it once I knew about the memorial. But I imagine it was quite wonderful, and I still see all the signs and the dead balloons. So, how many?
Actually, that's from the Tibetan group.
Okay, yeah. All right.
They overdid it with the signage.
Okay, well, you don't want to get lost on the way here. It's a Tibetan group. Oh, that makes sense. I did not know you were meeting in the small Zendo. So, beginner's mind is wonderful. I walked down the path here. So it maybe there was a sign up above, but I didn't see it. And I went straight to the big Zendo. And the first thing I thought was, why are everybody's shoes all over the place? And that should have been my first clue. But I forged ahead and went inside and stopped in the door and went, oh dear, what's this? It was as if I had interrupted a ceremony. And I don't know, maybe they were going through a special visualization process or something, but there was so much stuff on all the little tables in there, I thought, something is not right. And I came back and looked in the window, I thought, ah, here we are. But, you know, beginner's mind is just this wonderful thing of, you notice something is not quite the same, but it's not quite going in yet, and then all of a sudden you see this and you go, oh, okay, now we have to switch gears here. So, as I say, I have just returned literally this last week from this very long journey. And I do want to make the distinction between the word trip and the word journey, because I find them to be quite different things. Hi, come on up. Okay. I feel like a trip is something that has a definite destination, and that you do everything that you said you're going to do, and then you come home. And a journey is a different thing, because a journey isn't about having a destination. It's about the process of going and coming and everything that happens in between. So we're all on a journey all the time. You had an intermediate destination last weekend of this journey of many months of preparing for Kobin's memorial and inviting all these wonderful people to join you in that. And then you had the memorial, and then you had the after the memorial, and it's still with you now, just as Kobin is still with you now. And so the journey of Kobin's life is also not over and will not be as long as there is one person chanting his name. So a journey is sort of never ending. The journey of the Buddha is still going on. It may not go on through his particular body, but it is going on through time, through all of us. So when this trip to England was being planned, it was for the purpose of helping to chaperone 100 11 to 14 year olds for 3 weeks through the south of England. 15 children from my school went with me and one other teacher, who was actually the lead teacher in the program. I was just there to help. And in the beginning, for them, it's a trip, and it's a very exciting trip. Some of them had been with their parents to other places than our country, but none of them had ever been out of the country without their parents. And that is a very exciting thing indeed when you are 12 years old. So, of course, it also meant that they had no idea what they were doing or how to do it. Because when you're traveling with your parents, they're making all the decisions. They're telling you what's going to happen next, where you're going to go. They're buying all the tickets, they're providing the transportation, and basically they expect you to do what you are told. When you are traveling with in loco parentis, as I was, things are a little different. First of all, they don't know what the rules are anymore. Second of all, like Suzuki Roshi's very big field, we are shepherds more than the parent sheep. And we try to give them that very big field. But in that field, of course, then they suddenly have more choices to make, and therefore more responsibility, and therefore a lot more consequences. If they forget to pack something, well, there you are. You're kind of a long way from home and not much to do about it. Maybe we can buy it when we get there, but maybe not. If you bring your electronic equipment, but you forget to bring the adapter for European technology, well, there you are. And you may forget and plug it into the wall and it explodes, which happened. There are many things that happened. So in their minds, they were on a trip. But in my mind, because I've done this once before 5 years ago, I knew they were actually on a journey. Because the trip part was wonderful. I mean, anything you can think of that they could have gone to see in southern England, they saw. Because we were touring from 8:30 in the morning to 6:30 at night. 2 days in a row, and then one day off for the English staff to teach them English sports. So they got to learn cricket and rugby and what we call soccer, what they call football. And so they were on all the time. And, of course, you and I would know when it was time for us to take a little time for ourselves or to rest or to drink a lot of water, and instead, predictably, 5 days into the trip, we have kids coming going, I don't feel very good. Oh, I've got a really bad headache. And then you say, well, have you been drinking water? Water? Yes, water. You know that stuff that you drink. You get dehydrated very easily if you're not drinking water. Oh. And then you sit next to the child and you look at their plate for dinner, and there's this giant pile of mashed potatoes, a small pile of green beans, and that's it. And you say, where's the protein? Protein? They say. Yes, you know that stuff that puts energy into your body. Their parents, you see, have always taken care of that for them. And now we're asking them to take care of it themselves. This is all part of the journey. We as adults, we already know how to do these things, but 11, 12, 13-year-olds, they don't. So you forget some things that they don't know about. So one of the very last things that happened, we came back to San Francisco, we're collecting our luggage. One of the 14-year-old boys has his pack sitting on the ground, and the woman with the drug dog, the drug-sniffing dog, a beagle, makes a beeline for his pack. Huh. I'm thinking, whoa, what's this? It's a good thing she had gloves on. It's a three-compartment pack. She reaches into the first compartment, starts pulling stuff out, and reaches in and pulls out the deadest banana you have ever seen. Absolutely black, mushy. And I look at the boy, and he says, oh, I forgot. Okay. So she says, well, I have to look at the rest of the pack. Next compartment in, another dead banana. This one even worse. I'm really feeling sorry for the lady now. Because every day they had a packed lunch. And some of the stuff just went to the bottom of their pack. And you or I, getting ready to come home, would have emptied our pack out, reorganized it, put it back together, but not a 14-year-old boy. He, by this time, is mortified, as am I. But fortunately, the woman was quite good-humored about it and had a little baggie and put the dead bananas in it and went on. The beagle was disappointed because he didn't get it. But it's stuff like that. That's the journey of our lives. Are not these individual things like going to Stonehenge. Very informative, very wonderful, overwhelming, beautiful cathedrals, castles, gardens, Hampton Court, Blenheim Palace, you name it, we went there. After about a dozen tapestries, though, the 14-year-old mind can't take it in anymore, doesn't want to, walks right past a Rembrandt self-portrait that is not protected by glass or anything. It's just sitting on the wall of Windsor Castle. You can reach out and touch it. And by this time, they are so sick to death of all that, they are just motoring through to get to the gift store. No, it's a Rembrandt. A Rembrandt who? So, all of this is part of the journey of their moving towards adulthood. So I'm always reminded, you know, there are so many stories in our lineage, our Zen practice, of journeys. So many stories, you know, the monks would stay with their masters for 10, 15, 20 years, but then eventually they went out on the road. You know, either the master kicked them out, got tired of them, and said, please go, or they decided they were ready. And the reason they did this was, you know, in the monastery, you're very protected. Everything is taken care of for you, you know. There are people assigned. Maybe it's your turn to be assigned, but there are people assigned to make the meal. There are people assigned to keep the garden. There are people assigned to keep the zendo clean. Everybody has their job, and they get switched around, and you learn how to do everything. But it's really a pretty amazingly cohesive unit. You are being taken care of. But then you have to go back out in the world, and the world is not necessarily interested in taking care of you at all. In fact, they might even be obstructionist to your care. But every master understands that at some point the student has to go out there to find out if they can take this knowledge, this self-realization that they have gleaned on their cushion and test it in the real world. Because if it doesn't work in the real world, what is the good of it? So there are all these stories of monks going and visiting other masters or challenging monks on the road. And one of the most famous ones, the monk shows up at a monastery, Wumen or Mumon. Mumon says to him, so where are you from? And he names some village far away. And then he says, and where are you going? And the monk says, I don't know. And Wumen says, ah, not knowing is most intimate. I think the way I understood that when I first heard it 20 years ago was one way. I think I understand it a little differently now. I did understand that there was something to be said for not knowing, which was good because, you know, 25 years ago, I didn't know anything about Zen practice. And in fact, after 5 years of sort of banging my head against the wall, thinking I was supposed to know something, finally said, you know what? I am clearly too stupid to figure this Zen stuff out. Emptiness, I don't get it at all. No self, what? No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. This does not make sense to me. But I didn't come to understand this. I came to meditate, so I think I'll just do that. And lo and behold, if you sit on your cushion long enough, little by little, it comes through. But now I see that Wumen's not knowing is a little deeper than that. He's really talking about the nature of journey. You see, in a trip like I went on, there's an itinerary. When you first look at it, you think, 2 hours in the British Museum? How is that even possible? What can you do in the British Museum in 2 hours? But you go and you do your best and you run around and you see as much as you can. And so you get this little glimpse of the British Museum. And usually by the end of the day, and you ask the kids, so what was your favorite thing today? Often the answer was, what did we do this morning? because their days were so full. You know, you'd go and you'd visit the Houses of Parliament in the morning and the Winston Churchill Museum in the afternoon, and mostly what they remembered was the last thing they had done. But it was such a full day. Not to mention that we were there in all the preparation for the Olympics, and a million people are there. And so traveling with 100 kids, walking in lines through a million people, you can imagine, this is mind-boggling. But that's the trip part. That's the itinerary of our lives, and we all have itineraries. You know, get up at this hour, go take your shower, have your breakfast, go to your job, get your kids to school, do your homework, whatever it is that you have on your itinerary. That's the trip. But the journey, that's something quite different. The journey is what this wonderful Buddhist writer Musoeng calls point instance. It's point hyphen instant. Plural, instance, not C-E, but T-S. Point instance. Your entire life is nothing but point instance. Boom, 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 boom. You feel very solid and continuous. But the longer you sit, the more porous you begin to see everything is. And it's just nothing but these little point instance all day long. Flick, 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 flick. And in the middle of all those point instance is the journey of awakening. It's the journey of realizing this moment right here, right now. So these teachings that we talk about in the morning when we say the Buddha's teachings, you know, we're going to awaken to the Buddha's teachings, they are everywhere and at all times and in all people. You know, I think it's easy to forget that wisdom is everywhere, and that for whatever reason you're sitting here today, something brought you here. And it wasn't that you were raised in Zen practice. You know, it's too new to this country for that to have happened for us. I mean, you know, much younger people maybe, but for those of us who are over the age of 25, we came to it from something else. And certainly that was the case for me, that a lot of what I finally understood about Zen practice originally came to me from other sources. So I was raised a Catholic and then married a Jew and read widely and voraciously in all religious practices and humanism. And the reason I think I came to Zen practice, I mean, I think there are many things that happen, but all of those places, every now and then, something would be said about all those Zen masters. I remember one day reading in Aldous Huxley, and suddenly he said, yes, but Zen master so-and-so said, and finally thinking to myself, who are these guys? And finally finding a book, Zen and Japanese Culture, by D.T. Suzuki. I don't even remember why I picked that one up. And there, all in one place, was everything that I had already decided was true for me. And I was astounded. Wow. There's one thing that's got a name that contains what I've already experienced for myself. And so the first day I came to formal Zen practice, it felt completely familiar to me. It felt like home. Many people say that, but that was really the way it felt. It was like even the room, which I had never seen a formal zendo, but even the room looked familiar to me, and that was bizarre. I was like, wow, why does this look familiar? I don't know. But along the way, so many different people, authors, artists, musicians had added to my understanding who never practiced Zen. And again, that was part of my journey. So at one point on the trip, we're in Westminster Cathedral. And I don't know how many of you have been there, but many, many, many famous people are either buried there or at least memorialized. So you're standing in front of Isaac Newton's memorial. You're standing on Hooker's or next to Darwin. You know, it's like history is right here. Rafe Vaughan Williams and Edward Elgar, the musicians. And finally you come to Poets' Corner. All your favorite poets and writers are either buried or memorialized here. The Byrons, the Brownings, the Dickens, the Eliots. And when you look down, you see quotes. And this time, I have been there once before, but this time what caught my eye was something by one of my favorite authors, George Eliot, or Marianne Evans is her real name. But she said, "The first condition of human goodness is something to love. The second is something to reverence." Huh. I thought, there it is. There is our practice, all in a nutshell. Because what are we most afraid of? What is it that gets in our way? First of all, on the moment when we are lying about to die, there are two things we are going to want. One is the knowledge that we have loved and been loved. And the second is that we are not alone. The two biggest fears for people, the fear of not being loved and the fear of being alone. And she says, first condition of human goodness is something to love. The second, something to reverence. The first one is easier to understand, but the second one, all of a sudden I said, oh, that is why I needed a practice. Because I was raised as a Catholic, but there were things about the beliefs that I just could not wrap my mind around. But the reverence of it never left me. The honoring something bigger than just this small self here. And to me, that's one of the beauties of when we do service. And I'm bowing. Each of my 9 bows is specifically directed. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And then all of the dead teachers who have helped my life, all of the living teachers, and all of my own personal dead. That's the next 3. And then my personal family, my husband's personal family and my husband. And the last one is for all my friends, student, and Sangha, and anyone in particular who needs some special attention. So it struck me this morning, you know, Koban is part of my line of dead teachers who were very significant to me. So many people influence your journey. And George Eliot, because I read all her books and contains this kind of wisdom, certainly influenced mine. So George Eliot goes on through time, not because she's just such a good writer, but because it came from her heart. And she understood some things very deeply. And those things she understood, she presented in a fictional form, but nevertheless, the truths are there. Something to love puts us directly into a personal relationship with the world. This is important. We can't practice in an abstract way. This is why Sangha is so important. Sangha puts our practice right here in our body. And in the bodies of others, it connects us. Something to reverence, though, puts us in contact with big mind. This thing that we all are part of, that everything is a part of. Both things are important, significant, absolute. You know, sometimes we talk about the relative and the absolute. Both things have to happen. So, as I say, though, these teachings need to be tested. It's not enough to just sit on our cushion. It's not enough to do work practice together. We have to go out into the world where there are other people who may not be practicing, not in the way that we're familiar with. So, traveling with 100 children and 20 adults is a practice in and of itself. First of all, with our personal 15, you are constantly counting them. And this is made much more difficult because they're moving targets. They keep moving around, and you keep, wait a minute, I'm only getting 13. And the other teacher says, I think I'm getting 14. Well, would you all please stop moving? So finally we asked them to start doing the counting. Then they got it. Oh, we have to stand still for the counting to happen so we're not missing someone. Because here's the problem, and when they said it, I thought, oh, this is the same problem everyone has. Well, I know where I am. Yes, you know where you are, but there are 17 of us. Where's everyone else? That's the important question. But isn't this the same thing we all do? There's me, and then there's everyone else. And who's most important after all? So it takes 3 weeks at least for them to finally realize they are not the center of the universe. And it's a wonderful awakening when they finally understand, oh, I am one of many, and yes, I am important, but so is everyone else. So then there's the other part. You're traveling along. You're walking on the streets in London. You've got your 3 kids that are just motoring down the street. They don't know where they're going, but they're happy to lead. And then you've got the 3 back here who wander as if they have the rest of the day. And you're trying to keep this group together. And they don't get it. So I often took the tail end. I was the sheepdog, nipping at the heels. And sometimes they'd get really stubborn and sullen about it. Like, what's the matter with you? So on the last day that we took them into London, it's the day before the Olympics. Now, everybody is there now. And getting them on and off the tube and making sure that the littlest one, who was so short half the time you just couldn't even see her, and making sure the other ones didn't get too far ahead. It was really a practice. But fortunately on that day we only had to deal with our own 15, because everyone took their own groups off and did things. But these days were exacerbated by the fact that the whole first 2 weeks it rained constantly, just without end. And they were very good-humored about this. But the one thing they weren't very good-humored about was the strange food. You don't go to England for the food. But they didn't know this. So especially these bag lunches, that's why the bananas ended up at the bottom. Because they figured out very quickly. It's amazing how smart kids can be when they want to be. They figured out right away that wherever we went, there would probably be, first of all, food, and second of all, a gift store. They spent a lot of their money pretty quickly because, again, unlike us, they had no budget. They'd been given a certain amount of money, or they had earned a certain amount of money to take, and it was burning holes in their pockets. So in the first week, 2 children, one bought a 40-pound umbrella. Now, 40 pounds is about $60. It was like 40 pounds for an umbrella. We had talked to them about the conversion. We had taught them the arithmetic. And then comes the day we're in Bath, and one of the young 7th grade girls runs up to me with, she's got a bag of purchases. And I said, so what did you get? And she pulls out this beautiful skirt. It has lace on the outside. And she's so excited. She says, oh, Misha, it was originally 90 pounds, but then it was on sale for 60 pounds. I'm thinking, 60 pounds? $90 for this little skirt? Never said a word. Just like, you know what? It's their money, and there are consequences. So near the very end, you know, when you come back in the country, you have to sign that little declarations form. You have to say how much you've spent. And one, the boy with the umbrella, who lost it the week later, he says, Misha, you know, I've written down about the umbrella, but I guess I don't actually have to write it because I don't have it anymore, right? Right. So he wrote in a few, he says, but, you know, I know I took 150 pounds out of the ATM at three different times, but, wow, all I can account for is 50 pounds of it. And I said, yes, well, you know, every time you went into the food store, it was at least 5 pounds. So think of all the times you went and had tea or sweets or sandwiches. Or he starts adding it up. That's the journey. That is not the trip, you see. The trip was the itinerary. The trip were the places to go, but the journey is what we learn along the way. It's the process. So I was just reading this writer again, Lu Soeng. He said, the problem with the English language is that it's all about nouns. Right? And Buddhism is all about verbs. So this looks solid. It looks like a lectern. But of course, if we had the eyes of an electron microscope, what we would actually see was it's not solid. You know, maybe the electrons are moving very slowly, but it's not solid. So it's actually lecterning. It's not really lectern. And it's the same thing for us. That's why I differentiate between trip and journey, and I would even say it's journeying, because that is who we are. We are dynamic. We appear to be solid and not changing. I mean, Michael more or less looks the same as the last time I saw him, but you see, I know he's not.
Getting younger.
That's right, in before my eyes. Everything about him actually has changed. In 7 years' time, every single cell in your body has died and regenerated. So it's that old story of having the axe, okay? So first of all, you hit the axe wrong enough times and you've got to replace the stem of it, the wood. But then eventually comes the day when the metal part of it gets too dull and it just can't be sharpened anymore, so you have to replace that. Well, is it the same axe or not? Not really, and neither are you. So our practice is actually this incredibly dynamic thing that is always in motion. We are not solid. We are never the same moment to moment. These point instants are just flickering, 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 bringing us into existence and dying out, and bringing us and dying out, and over and over and over. And so we are journeying at each moment. Now, why is this important to remember? Well, because the place where we suffer is when the motion stops. When we get stuck in something. It's like we've been moving along at 60 miles an hour, and then all of a sudden, the brakes come on. And as long as we're standing still like that, we are suffering. So, 2 weeks into the trip, when the kids have the stay days for sports, the adults from the States are allowed a little time off. So this other teacher and myself decide to go into London to scope out the day we're going to take them back later in the week on our day alone. Now, you have to remember, for 2 weeks I've been traveling with 100 people, or 120 people. And so I've been extra vigilant. Anything that comes out of my backpack, very careful when I'm paying money, put everything back in, zip the backpack up. Because, you know, during the Olympics especially, we know that whole gangs of pickpockets have come specifically for the Olympics from all over Europe. They know this. So they've been warning all visitors, be very careful. Keep your valuables close. Don't show them around much. Make sure you've got a closed backpack. If you can, in fact, keep it in front of you. So we've told the kids this. So while I'm with them, I know that 100 kids are very distracting. So I have been hyper-vigilant. But now it's just me and this other person. So the day before, we had gone to the Globe Theater to see a production of Richard III. And it was absolutely mobbed. It was a sold-out performance because the man playing Richard, such a fabulous actor. It was a treat to see this. But, of course, all the kids afterwards want to go to the gift store. And it is mobbed in the gift store. So I just give up. I'm watching them enjoying themselves, getting postcards or whatever it is they're getting. And there's a line 6 to 7 people deep, and it takes them a while to get through. So I just, you know, not going to buy any postcards, which is mostly what I was buying when I went places. But the next day, when I come back with just my friend, we go to the Globe because it's the nearest loo. We go inside, we use the loo, and we come back out, and there's hardly anybody in the gift store this day because there's no performance going on at that moment. So she says, oh, did you want to get some postcards? I said, well, great opportunity. So I go get my postcards. We go up to the cashier's counter. Now, because we've been traveling for 2 weeks, you start to empty things out of your pack that are unnecessary, which is another thing the kids didn't learn. At one point, my littlest one, she's so far behind, and I reach up and I hold up her backpack. There's like 50 pounds of stuff in it. No wonder she's going so slow. So we made her leave her books on the bus after that. But I myself am emptying my bag of as much as I can. So I had taken my cash and my credit cards and put them in the front zippered pocket of my passport case and put the passport in the back zippered pocket. So I now lift it out of my backpack, which is firmly between my feet on the floor. I drop it on the counter to hear if there's change. There is, but here's the problem. I can see, I have contacts, I can see fine, but for reading purposes, I now need these. Well, the problem is I don't know the money very well. So I've got all this change in my hand, and I cannot read what it says without going back down to get my glasses. But my friend, she's Miss England, and she knows all. So she goes into teacher mode and starts, well, you know, when it has an octagonal, it's this, and when it's small, it's that. And she's explaining the whole thing. So now I'm getting distracted. She pulls the right amount of change. We hand it to the woman behind the counter. The woman hands me my postcards. I lean down below the counter to stick them in my backpack. And after that, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Either it was already gone, or I didn't realize I hadn't put it in, and I walked away. Half an hour later, I realized my passport case and all my money and all my credit cards are gone. What happens? First of all, fear arises. Second of all, immediately the mind goes into where was I, you know, back, knowing that it was not taken out of my pack. Because when I stopped and found out, I had had to unzip my pack completely, so I know that it hasn't happened on the way. We hook it back to the Globe Theater. I run up to the counter, hoping, you know, praying to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please have mercy on me. Get up there, and she looks at me and says, no, I haven't seen it. She's not very helpful. She won't look behind the counter. She just keeps saying, no, I haven't seen it. But there's a lost and found downstairs. They haven't seen it. So now there I am. I have to call the police, who I have to say throughout this whole thing were fabulous. I wish I could say the same thing about the American Embassy, which was about as unhelpful as they could possibly be. First of all, it's a Saturday afternoon. I'm trying to call my husband to cancel the credit cards, and he is golfing, probably with you. So I can't reach him. It's all his fault, that's right. I can't reach him, so now I'm worried they're using the credit cards. They can't really use the ATM, but also I realize, now here's a weird one. When you're in the States, you have your driver's license pretty much wherever you go. Somebody, if you get in an accident, will know who you are. They will know who to contact. You'll have a little card in there that says who to contact. I am now without any identification at all. So the first thing I do is I sit down and I write a piece of paper with my name, my address, my phone number, the contacts, you know, in case of emergency. So finally, we go online that night. It takes 20 minutes to even discover a phone number to call. My phone does not work within the dorms. I have to actually walk 500 yards away to get signal. So I'm out in the dark, sitting next to a little lighted area, dialing in this number, going through every possible menu, not getting a person. They keep saying, go online, go online. And then the funny one, when they finally get to the menu, it says, if you cannot use the internet, please send us your information and we will send you a packet. It's like, great. What if I didn't even have an address? So we go back, and we go back online to try and find the place. It keeps saying, make an appointment online. Okay. It takes another 10 minutes to figure out how to make the appointment. And then when we do go to the appointment, the first available date was yesterday. Actually, Friday. Yesterday, Friday. It's like, great, I'm leaving on Sunday. Whoops. All of this time, I'm watching the nervousness arise, the anxiety arise, the body getting tight, because I'm supposed to leave on Sunday to help bring home 15 children for whom I am responsible. I don't know how long it takes to get a new passport. Long story short, I have to stay back from the trip on Monday because the embassy doesn't open till 9 o'clock, but I have to leave for the tour at 8:30, so I have to stay home. They get on the phone, proceed to tell me that I have to go online, and then I break in and say, I'm sorry, but my plane is leaving first thing Sunday morning. Oh, all right, hold on. 2 seconds later, they come back. Okay, you can have an appointment at 8 o'clock Friday morning. Now, this is cutting things kind of close. Also, 8 o'clock in the morning means I have to get up at 5 in order to get in there. And it's also the opening day of the Olympics. So there's going to be massive crowds. But instead, I just say, thank you very much. So then I have an option. I can treat this as a trip. I can get really whacked out. I can not enjoy the last week of my time there. I can make other people uncomfortable around me. I can, you know, even make maybe the kids worry. But that's not the journey. The journey we have as practitioners is, okay, this is the way it is now. Now what are you going to do? You're going to try to enjoy the rest of your time to the best of your ability. And when the anxiety arises, you're going to breathe and you're going to try and let it back go. So that's what I did for the next 5 days. Wonderful news, Thursday morning, we're on the coach going into London for our day with just our kids. And a phone call comes from the director of my program there. You want the good news first or the bad? Good news, of course, he says. Your passport has been turned in to the Walworth Street Police Station. What could possibly be bad after that? He says, you know, you're going to have to go get it. Turns out it is in a terrible part of town. I have to go on the tube by myself for the first time through one of the most labyrinthine stations that exists, all by myself, and I do it, and I feel very competent now on the tube how to do it. But having that passport in my hand, I thought, wow, how dependent we are on this little piece of paper that says, you exist. It has nothing to do with your existence, but it certainly makes life more difficult, be hard coming home. So all this time, what it really came home to me in all of this was, when the child bought their 40-pound umbrella and then promptly lost it the next week, there was some part of me inside going, oh dear, dear, dear. Kind of a smug adult response. And there I lose my passport, which is a much bigger thing to lose. It was a reminder. Suffering is suffering. You can't compare it. You can't judge it. You can't think yours is more than someone else's or less. It's all suffering. So that when my little nursery kids come into the library and they start having a meltdown because they don't get to sit next to their little friend that day, You can't sit there and go, oh, it's such a small problem. My problems are so much bigger. No, for them, it's the biggest problem in the universe. And it's all, the journey is what gives us perspective about our suffering. Because we can see that there are much worse things that could happen. And in this case, the worst thing that could have happened was to lose a kid, not a passport. When we can keep that very big mind, we can relax a little more with our suffering. We can enjoy the journey more. Because the journey is never the itinerary. Things are never going to happen according to your itinerary. You know, my brother used to have these 5-year plans. And I used to think, what? And, you know, in the first 5 years, we're having our 2 kids. In the next 5 years, we're going to, you know, move into the new house. And so, of course, along the way, something happened to his 5-year plan and his wife decided to leave him. This was not on the itinerary. And it was a real blow and really difficult for him. He had a very hard time adjusting. But this actually is the beauty of our practice. We understand, as time goes on, that it is the journey. And the journey is to keep us flexible and meeting each of these point instants as they come up without getting stuck, without stopping. It is the stopping of that motion that is our suffering. So in that first moment when I realized everything of, you know, my valuables was missing, the world came to a screeching halt. So I am very grateful for practice because it came back together again. And I really did have a very good time in my last week. So I wish you all very well on your journey of finding something and someone to love and something to reverence, including your practice and each other and all beings. Thank you.